welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guests today are Stephen Wertheim, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Matt Duss, a visiting scholar at Carnegie and former foreign policy advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders. Stephen, Matt, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
You guys have written an essay in the latest issue of The New Republic, which serves as a kind of report card for President Biden's foreign policy. And in it, you write that progress under Biden has been incremental rather than fundamental. Before we get into the pros and cons of Biden's term so far, I'm curious what happens in your minds when you use those words. What are the kind of fundamental changes in contrast to incremental ones that you two would like to see in U.S. foreign policy?
Sure. I mean, I can take a first shot at that. I mean, I think as we note in the piece, I mean, this is, and you know, Biden and his team recognized on the campaign, in the platform, and since that this is a transformational moment in a lot of ways. America's relative share of power is diminishing. The unipolar moment is over, whatever cliche from Washington foreign policy cliche one would like to use. So at least at the rhetorical level, there's an understanding that, you know, U.S. foreign policy needs to be put on a much stronger footing for the new era. There's a, you know, some understanding that comes into that, too, with stuff we've seen from Biden himself, but also from kind of key foreign policy advisors like National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who've recognized, you know, the failure of the neoliberal, you know, model of globalization and trade that has not delivered prosperity for, you know, huge numbers of Americans, and the impact that has made on our politics, you know, and the basic responsibility of U.S. foreign policy, which is to deliver security and prosperity for Americans. So I think, you know, there's been an understanding that there's been this disconnect in a lot of ways between the way foreign policy is discussed and conducted from the lived experience of a lot of Americans. I think the question that we get at in the piece, and obviously Stephen can say more about this, is, okay, how does that look in practice? Where are they focusing? Where are they really getting their backs into that transformation? And thus far, do we see that, this, you know, how far does this kind of reinvention go, and how hard do old habits actually die?
Yeah, and I've written elsewhere that I'd like to see the United States adopt a much smaller political military role in the world and reduce its forward deployments and security commitments. But in this piece, Matt and I really tried to judge the Biden administration by its own standards. So we were trying to judge them, you know, not by the ideal, although our, you know, biases always factor in, but largely by what the Democratic Party platform of 2020 actually said that Democrats wanted to do. And that was a pretty good process where the party was able to share insights from both wings of the Democrats and, you know, put together a pretty good consensus document that actually, I think, reflected a sober look at where the United States is in the world. And then, of course, a lot of events have happened since Biden came in. And I think that's distracted the administration from some extent from pursuing some of the reformist insights that it put forward in the campaign and especially through that platform.
One of the areas of praise that you guys have for Biden is his withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was harrowing but ultimately necessary. We'll get to the criticisms in a second, but where else do you think he deserves some credit?
I mean, as we note in the piece, I mean, I think he does deserve credit for the handling of Ukraine, which I think, interestingly, as you know, as someone who is kind of in the, I guess, restraint camp or at least restraint curious, I think Biden's approach qualifies as restraint, certainly compared to what many in Washington have been urging him to do. I think he's held back from some of that. Now it's all relative, but I do think the way that he's, you know, the kind of, as we talk about the kind of alliance management work in multilateral institutions, in support of Ukraine's defense has been very adept. So that's one area. I mean, I think there are a few other things. I think, you know, at least, you know, if we're talking about the end of the kind of, you know, Reaganite Washington trade consensus, I think the support for a global minimum corporate tax is another very, very important step that reflects that understanding. But again, this is where we start to get into, okay, how much of your energy are you really putting into moving that forward?
Biden has also somewhat quietly reduced drone strikes. We say that he's not on track to end the war on terror, but nevertheless, I think there's definite progress over the last few years. You know, a ceasefire was brokered in Yemen. And again, this is not an area where we give overall praise to the administration, but the administration has engaged diplomatically to try to resolve that conflict in a way that the previous one didn't. So I think there are some bright spots in the administration. And just on Ukraine, I think we don't know fully what the administration tried diplomatically in order to try to head off the invasion. But, the support of Ukraine, I think we have to say, as of now, has been quite successful in avoiding a direct conflict, but also in allowing Ukraine to remain independent. There are a lot of negatives, too. I think the sanctions have not worked, and we need to take a very serious look at what happened with those sanctions, which I think a lot of people understood were unlikely to have a positive effect, even when they were implemented. So it says a lot about our politics that the sanctions have been applied in this cascade as they were. So, you know, things could end up very bad in Ukraine. We don't want to gloss over that. But as of now, keywords as of now, I think that's a bright spot.
Yeah, I'll just add quickly to that. I mean, first on, you know, drone strikes and the kind of broader war on terror, we have seen, you know, a shift in policy, really serious diminishing of the number of drone strikes. But again, that legal framework, as far as we know, still exists for future administrations to take up. And while we do recognize, and I do think this is a key point, is yes, they've understood correctly that doing this stuff quietly and without fanfare is a way to avoid kind of messy political fights and controversy. But at the same time, if we are trying to create a durable new consensus around America's approach, you have to wage and win those arguments in order to establish a new kind of legal and political consensus. And they seem to be avoiding that, again, understandably, but I think there are consequences to that. And the second point on sanctions, and I do think this is something that we've seen in some of the response, and I think it's a very fair criticism, is that we didn't spend as much time as we perhaps could have or mentioning the sanctions piece, not just on Russia, but more broadly. Because even though they did roll out, you know, a kind of sanctions reform agenda, in practice, they are still as sanctions happy as any administration we've seen recently. I mean, they've continued with Trump sanctions on Iran. We mentioned that they very likely have lost the Iran deal. But I think, you know, really, really, you know, taking a hard look at the use of sanctions, their impacts on civilian populations, and whether they are actually producing, you know, the kind of change that we want to see, or whether they're just kind of this tool that we use to demonstrate that we are, quote unquote, serious about, you know, opposing bad governments, it still remains to be seen.
So I think John originally asked us about the bright spots. And as you can see, we've devolved very quickly into criticisms.
In fairness, we did mention those, and then we moved on.
Well, yeah, there was a lot in there, and I want to tease some of it out. Since we're on the issue of sanctions, I'll start there. You know, sanctions, my understanding at least, is that the academic literature has been pretty clear that they tend to be pretty ineffective. They aren't successful in changing the policies of the target regime in the direction that we would like. The reason I think policymakers overuse them is because they're so politically useful. It sort of shows I can do something, here's me being tough, but the effectiveness question is down the road, so I'll just get credit for this. But lately, especially during Trump, when we started to sanction our European allies and try to pressure them which way and the other, you know, I think the word's getting round the international community that the United States, which has the reserve currency, is using economic coercion as a matter of routine, and it's sort of creating a global constituency that resents this. And that seems like it could present real problems down the line.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point. You know, As to the efficacy of sanctions, I think you're right. I mean, the academic literature, let's just say at the very least, raises very, very serious questions about whether they actually produce the kind of changes that, you know, that policymakers propose. I think there are some examples, like Iran, where sanctions played a part. Sanctions were not the whole story, but I think they did play a part in the kind of broad set of, you know, pressure and negotiation that won. Another big part of that was that the United States and its allies, or specifically the United States, finally arrived at what it saw as a concession on Iran's own domestic nuclear capability that Iran had claimed for a long time, I think with some legal grounding it was entitled to. But finally, the United States, you know, coming to an agreement, an off-ramp that was realistic. And I think that is, so again, this is a whole discussion to be had about when and how sanctions are useful. But I think your last point, John, is really important, because what we've seen is that sanctions, especially under Trump, again, staying with Iran, are not necessarily a way of changing a foreign government's behavior, but in restricting and constraining future U.S. administration's diplomacy. You know, the maximum pressure crowd was very open that what they were trying to do was just pile on all kinds of sanctions that would create political headaches domestically for the next duly elected president, and prevent that president from carrying out the policy that he or she had campaigned on. And that, in my view, is frankly fundamentally undemocratic. So that's bigger than just a sanctions problem. That just gets to the kind of nature of our foreign policy debate.
The administration talked about doing a sanctions review that might lead to some much stricter standards and rollback of sanctions. And obviously, we're not seeing that. In the case of the war in Ukraine, I hope that future historians will take a close look at how and why the large-scale sanctions on Russia got imposed at the start of its invasion. I think it's an interesting question. I actually wonder, you know, how many members of the administration thought that the sanctions would be effective in getting Russia to stop its war. I suspect that there was a lot of skepticism, but there was a perceived need to be doing something that would impose costs on Russia. And initially, the assumption was that Russia would achieve its military goals fairly easily and quickly in Ukraine. And so I think there was a desire to do something that would signal punishment for Russia. But I do wonder whether if those decision makers had known that military assistance would be very effective, not to mention, of course, Ukraine's own resistance to Russia's bungled operation, whether they would have gone quite so far in imposing those sanctions so rapidly at the beginning.
I mean, I think just a last quick point on that. I mean, agree with everything Stephen said, but we have to differentiate types of sanctions and what they are focusing on as well. And I do think there's some evidence that, you know, some of the sanctions have, you know, prevented or at least slowed Russia's ability to resupply and obtain certain materials to keep its military going. It's obviously not stopped it. Russia is continuing to find other ways. And again, that could be one of the consequences here. Russia does seem to have learned lessons from Iran's experience in running a decades-long sort of resistance economy under international isolation. But again, I think I'll reference here a very good recent book by Agatha Demaret, which I'm going to be doing hopefully an event here at Carnegie in the next few weeks. A new book called Backfire, about U.S. sanctions and about how just the kind of reckless and constant use of these sanctions by the United States, as you said, John, not just on targeted regimes, but on our own allies, forcing them, you know, to follow our preferred policy rather than their own democratically decided policy, has created not only a lot of resentment, but a lot of the creation of alternatives. And workarounds. And that is going to have, again, very serious consequences for any sanctions efficacy in the future.
You guys offered some a nod of credit for the administration's approach to Ukraine. And I understand that. We've aided Ukraine and undermined Russia's invasion without, so far at least, triggering major escalation or some kind of direct military intervention. On the other hand, there are risks of adopting a logic of managing the war that deepens and prolongs it. And we've also doubled down on maintaining Europe as essentially a U.S. protectorate. And of course, many Americans are opposed to the costs of our indirect approach. Stephen, you wrote in a recent Financial Times piece that Biden should have used the Russian invasion to encourage European defense autonomy, but instead he's done the opposite and increased Europe's reliance on the U.S. Can you discuss that a bit?
Well, the Biden administration sent about 40,000 U.S. troops to Europe over the past year when it started to see Russia's invasion coming. That in and of itself is understandable, but Europe experienced a real shock as a result of Russia's invasion. And I think there's a pretty widespread understanding in the U.S. on both sides of the aisle here that the U.S. faces a risk of overstretch. It's especially true now that U.S. relations with Russia and China have become much more antagonistic over the past few years. And it would make sense to signal very strongly that the United States needs to shift the burden onto its European allies for European defense. This is something that European states, clearly have the latent military capability to achieve the, GDP of Europe compared to Russia. We're talking about, 4 or 5 times the GDP at the most conservative estimate, even more if you use other statistics. So this is something that can happen, but I think we're kind of caught in a bind because the Biden administration doesn't want to signal any kind of, abandonment. And that leaves Europeans with insufficient incentives to step up and start, raising their spending and, most importantly, using that spending to replace U.S. capabilities rather than actually lock the United States more into a leadership role in NATO. And so I, one of the things Matt and I may disagree on this, but, I think it was not wise for the administration to champion the expansion of NATO to Finland in particular, which, has an 830-mile land border with Russia. To me, it's almost a kind of vote of no confidence in European defense, since Finland is part of European defense arrangements. I think, I understand, I think, what the administration was driving at, which was to ensure what it called a strategic failure for Russia overall, even if Russia might end up making some territorial gains as a result of this conflict. So I get that impulse, but at the same time, this is a moment where the Russian military has been weakened, thankfully. It's bogged down in Ukraine. It's not going anywhere anytime soon, at least we hope, but it doesn't have the capability even to be terribly successful, it seems, in its own intended goals in Ukraine. So this is actually a pretty good time, I think, to effectuate the beginnings of a security transition where the United States would move to a supporting role in European defense, but not the leading role. That's not going to happen overnight, but I think Joe Biden is a pretty capable person, if he wanted to try and, achieve this over the 6 years that he has remaining in his potential time in office.
As you guys mentioned earlier, in a real sense, the global war on terror, so to speak, is still ongoing. Biden is still engaged in drone strikes. He's still citing very outdated legal authorities to engage in a kind of global war. And I think this, the key point that you try to make on this in the piece, and I think this makes sense, is that those incremental kinds of changes on this front are dangerous because it leaves in place the architecture for a future president to continue these policies or even expand them. So what's needed is kind of boldness to stop the ratchet effect, right? This problem of crises in foreign policy expanding the power of the executive. And then once those crises end, you know, there's no contraction in the authority. So if you read between the lines, why don't you think there's been more boldness from the administration on this front? Are they just overloaded with other priorities?
I mean, in basic terms, it's, you know, the cliche that where you stand is where you sit, you know, you know, and when a lot of these folks were outside of government, they quite understood quite clearly and starkly, given who was the previous president, that these powers could be used, let's just say irresponsibly, but recklessly. But presidents, you know, the executive is, no matter who it is always going to be extremely hesitant to kind of constrain themselves or relinquish power. Again, that's not the whole story, but I think that is a big part of it. As we referenced in the piece, there is legislation that has been introduced to deal with some of these issues. If there are concerns with the language of that legislation, that's a process that I know. And again, this is, you know, my previous boss, Senator Sanders, was one of the sponsors of this, along with Senator Chris Murphy and Senator Mike Lee. A very large bill, the National Security Reform Act, that dealt with not just the AUMFs, but a whole kind of set of authorities that previous administrations had been using. You've also got the 2002 AUMF repeal for Iraq that Senator Kaine has introduced multiple times and has said he will do again, for a kind of a much smaller focus approach on this issue. But yet we've not really seen a willingness from the administration to really engage on this. So yeah, I do think partially it's just kind of a bandwidth issue, given the number of concerns and crises they've got to deal with day to day. But I do think there is always going to be just kind of inherent aversion and kind of allergy to, you know, kind of, as they would see it, kind of handcuffing themselves.
Still, it's so remarkable that, you know, it's not that I have to invent the specter of the next Trump or something. Literal Donald Trump is the Republican front runner and the only declared candidate for president. So, yeah, you stand where you sit, but like the Biden administration officials are sitting in chairs that could well be occupied by somebody appointed by Donald Trump in just a couple years. And there was a whole lot of seemingly, you know, soul-searching discussions about the connections between domestic and foreign policy and the need to constrain executive power in the years prior to Biden taking office. And I'm just so struck by how the national security strategy, except for like one text box, would be seemingly written exactly the same had the previous president been a law-respecting, you know, Mitt Romney, and Donald Trump had never, you know, walked down the escalator. So it's quite something to me. I do think that, you know, maybe there's an opportunity in the next few years as the presidential campaign looms to bring back some of these issues, including in Congress, where, you know, Republicans will control the House, but, you know, they have a Democratic president that they can try to seek to restrain. And Democrats, for their part, can look ahead to a potential Republican president. Now, everybody on the Hill seems to tell me, oh, no, this is not a priority. This is not the right time. That seems to signal that there is no right time for this kind of reform. But, you know, I think this is potentially a moment where AUMF reform or something of that nature could move forward. So I'd certainly like to see that.
What's the foremost reason the administration has failed to re-up the Iran nuclear deal?
I think your last two questions come down to another factor also, which is some domestic political timidity, from my point of view, on the part of the Biden administration. I think Biden was reluctant to be criticized as weak on national security, as many Democrats are. I think that may have affected the early steps in an attempt to restore the Iran nuclear agreement, but not to give up the Trump sanctions as a first step. but instead to try to use those sanctions as leverage. Unfortunately, there was limited time before the next leader of Iran was going to take power, as the administration knew. That is part of how we get to the seemingly dead Iran nuclear deal that we have today. I also think that the politics of the Afghanistan withdrawal have proved unfortunate. I think that the administration came away thinking that restraint kinds of actions in foreign affairs are costly. Biden's approval numbers diminished significantly over the course of the, you know, last month of the withdrawal. That said, the dip in his numbers preceded the beginning of intense coverage of the Afghanistan withdrawal, and might have had more to do with COVID numbers rising after Biden had seemed to say that his measures had been successful in being able to return the country to some semblance of normalcy. So, you know, I think whatever the exact reality of the Afghanistan withdrawal in terms of its impact on Biden, I think the administration unfortunately drew the lesson that it should be quite cautious in doing similar kinds of actions in the future.
President Biden himself thought that they could hold out, not seem too eager, and potentially get, you know, the Iranians to do something. I'm not sure what. I mean, there's also, you cannot discount the fact that, at least from their perspective, they had to deal with some very conservative Democrats who they foresaw as potentially being problems on the issue. I find that kind of wild, given the fact that Biden had been elected on an entirely unequivocal commitment to rejoin the deal, and coming into office with that at his back, and then choosing to wait as he did. I think we all see the consequences of it. And there's also the fact that, you know, even though Biden publicly had made a very strong case for why quickly rejoining the deal was the right move in a piece he wrote for CNN in October of 2020, it's clear that, you know, he was personally not super invested in that approach. That became clear very, very quickly. I think we made a point to just unequivocally say in the piece that he broke that promise. I mean, there's just no way around that. He made a very clear commitment and he broke it. It's not the only one, but I think it is potentially one of the most consequential.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. It's been a point of frustration for me because it seemed to me coming in that this was a kind of low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. They had the ability, especially with some concessions and a more flexible posture, to get back in that deal.
And a better Iranian government than they got by waiting.
Right. Biden has repeatedly said he doesn't want a Cold War with China, but his policy repeatedly tells a different story. That's a quote from your piece. And Stephen, in that Financial Times piece, you described U.S.-China relations as in free fall. Talk about the administration's approach to China and fill us in on what you think would make more sense going forward.
I think that actually this is the area where I would probably fault the administration or Joe Biden himself the most. It's so dangerous to play around with the Taiwan issue in particular. I mean, we're talking about the risk of World War III, no exaggeration here. And there's a good understanding, which Biden himself articulated in an op-ed back in the George W. Bush years when he criticized George W. Bush for getting the one China policy wrong. You know, I think there's a pretty good understanding of where China's red line lies here. And yet, in a series of so-called gaffes, the president has misstated U.S. policy, saying that the U.S. has a commitment to defend Taiwan, that he would send U.S. troops to Taiwan if attacked by China, and also said a few times that the issue of Taiwanese independence is up to the people of Taiwan, which is not U.S. policy. The U.S. policy, the one China policy, which the White House says is also still intact and hasn't changed, says that the United States does not support Taiwan independence. That's not quite the same as outright opposing it, although several presidents have said that we outright oppose it at various times. But we don't support it. So it's not just an issue that we think is up to Taiwan. So, you know, I think this is all contributing to an impression that some have in Beijing that the one China policy lives on borrowed time, even if it is not going to be entirely overturned in the Biden administration. And then that gets us, I think, closer to the possibility of a really ruinous conflict. Now, you know, absent that, and I think a lot of those statements are down to Joe Biden, the individual. Many in his administration, you know, don't say those kinds of things. In fact, the White House always puts out a statement saying, actually, you know, we really are following the one China policy. So that's better than, I guess, breaking with the one China policy. But we should also look ahead to see what Republicans might do with this opportunity, because senior members of the Trump administration have now said that they want to resolve strategic ambiguity to make a clear U.S. commitment to defend Taiwan, which I think would be quite risky and destabilizing. And then on the economic front, you know, most notably, I think the Biden administration has put out a rule to restrict China from being able to import advanced semiconductors. And, you know, I'm not against all forms of so-called decoupling that have occurred to date. I think there was a risk of Huawei, if it were allowed to provide 5G networks around the world, some national security risks there. But targeting advanced semiconductors, it's just a kind of crucial part of an advanced economy. And so I think that at least gives the impression, maybe unintended by some actors in the Biden administration, but nevertheless gives the impression that the United States wants to cripple the high-end development of China's economy. And again, we have to ask, what are the second and third order effects of these moves? So on the other hand, you know, coming out of this year, there was a high level meeting between Presidents Biden and Xi, and potentially a prospect of renewed diplomacy in the next year or so. But now the politics of U.S.-China relations, the domestic politics in particular, have gotten really terrible. And with the Republicans coming into control of the House, they've already pledged to set up this select committee on China with an avowed aim of waging the Cold War against China, which is supposed to be a line of criticism that people who don't like a Cold War are supposed to be using. Now it seems to be perfectly acceptable.
So there's something I want to push back against you guys on one part of your piece, and that's like basically what to how to organize U.S. foreign policy around something. You know, there's a couple of problems when we talk about shifting from where we are now and towards restraint. One problem is that foreign policy is pretty low salience for voters. You know, it's not a thing that people get driven to the polls for. And then the other problem is that without a crusade or some kind of ever encroaching enemy, it can be hard to gin up the energy for constant global warfare and nearly $1 trillion in annual national security spending. And I've noticed that many of my allies on the left, you know, restraint-oriented people on the left, like everyone, I guess, are at a bit of a loss as to how to create political momentum towards restraint. And you guys kind of provided a perfect example of what I often see on the left, which is You know, you talk about things like trade and global corruption and global minimum wages and minimum corporate taxes internationally and climate change and pandemics, too. We'll talk about that in a sec. But it sort of seems like in lieu of a crusade, you guys are saying what we'll do is we'll extend the rhetoric of successful domestic initiatives to then give ourselves purpose and direction in foreign policy. And I just kind of wonder about the risks of giving new energy to new initiatives to our massive military industrial complex to then go and manage global affairs that way. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair critique. I don't know if I quite agree that's the argument we made, because I certainly would share the caution around trying to redefine everything as national security. I mean, I think, you know, I've written, you know, in the work I did with Bernie, and is, you know, around the idea, like, listen, you know, rebuilding America and doing things that promote our democracy here, strengthen our democracy here, that strengthen Americans' welfare is, you know, justifiable in and of itself. That is the number one responsibility of the United States government. That is our collective political project. But I do think, you know, stipulating that, we can then turn to, okay, what is American foreign policy for? It needs to preserve and protect those things. And I think you can and should make an argument for how these different ideas and these different policies and initiatives globally either protect or expand, or at the very least, do not undermine those initial domestic goals. But again, coming from this, as I said earlier, as someone who is, you know, sort of within the restraint camp, but also as someone who identifies strongly as a left progressive, I take very seriously the idea of solidarity with people around the world. And so the way that, you know, looks to me is, you know, we have to take into account, okay, what are the impacts and consequences of these policies, not just on us, but on the communities that endure them? And again, this is what I think has kind of undergirded my strong critique of the global war on terror for many years, for the kind of, you know, neoliberal trade regime that Washington finally seems to be waking up and understanding has not really worked out all that well for lots and lots of people. But still, that's kind of an additional argument that I make, understanding that not everyone else, and you know, conservatives don't tend to see it that way. But I think we can agree on the basic premise that, you know, domestic security and prosperity here in the United States is what the United States government is supposed to promote.
I think you should like us more, John. Let me give you let me give you two reasons. First of all, what we're saying is that the United States should act in the best interest of the United States, first and foremost. We're not, you know, saying that we should be selfish and that should come at the expense of others necessarily. But, you know, we think that climate change, pandemic disease, these are things that really do affect Americans where they live and work more than, you know, most conventional military challenges. So that's why we think that, you know, the U.S. role in the world, U.S. foreign policy should be reoriented around those challenges. And I don't think that gives much for the military industrial complex to work with. I think actually it would lead to problems for the military industrial complex, which is okay with me. Let me make a second point also as to why you should like us. You know, the challenge that you would have, I think, in making your appeal is that the United States has a fairly kind of moralistic can-do political culture. And I think Americans do care about America's general role in the world, and even to an extent how we treat others and how they treat us. So these things do matter. And, you know, I think the idea of simply saying to people, well, let's focus on our own problems and let's basically do nothing around the world isn't one that is very appealing politically. So even, you know, if you even don't agree with us on the kind of substantive argument, I think there's a presentational and political challenge that that is tricky for restrainers. And I think here actually people on the left have something to contribute, and hopefully something that's not easy for folks in the military-industrial complex to appropriate.
Mr. Wertheim, you know full well I got much love for you guys. The show works better if I ask probing questions, though. Okay. And for the last one, this is kind of a tough one, actually, because even in my very limited government, restraint-oriented view of foreign policy, you know, climate change is something we need to look at. But I do wonder how much of it is manipulable by U.S. policy. You know, it's a collective problem that can only be seriously dealt with through collective action. And first of all, I mean, trying to coordinate positive collective action in the international community, especially if it includes some kind of self-sacrifice, is extremely difficult. The incentive structure works against it strongly. So what's a realistic way for U.S. foreign policy to address climate change?
Yeah, I mean, I can take a shot at that one. First is just meeting our existing commitments, right? I mean, the United States has been engaged in a number of agreements, including the Paris Accord, that set some goals. So work to meet those goals and be seen to be meeting them. I think that's first off a way of demonstrating that, you know, these agreements should be honored. I mean, that's going to have impacts just beyond climate. That's going to have impacts, I think, in the broader effort to deal with, you know, shared challenge multilaterally. I think, you know, in the developing world, in places like Africa, which are, you know, modernizing very rapidly, a very young population, they're going to be meeting some of these resource needs and infrastructure development already at a very, very steady clip. And then I think there's a good argument, not just for, you know, saving the environment, but also for, you know, for building real partnerships with these countries and with these populations on the basis of renewable energy. So I think those are just the two reasons why.
Yeah, I think you could think about this on a couple levels. Like, one is building a normative environment internationally that promotes the green transition. And, you know, I think the Biden administration has made some real strides building on the Paris framework. That's what that was about. We see even, you know, U.S. competitors like China be responsive to this, perhaps for their own reasons. But nevertheless, it's not just in actions like China's pledge to stop financing new brown energy projects internationally, but also in the way, you know, the Chinese leadership has staked its own credibility on being a positive player on climate. Now, that's far from the case when China, the main problem lies within China, right, with all of its greenhouse gas emissions. But I think, you know, that's a positive step to at least sort of change the normative climate and start to create a race to the top rather than the bottom. And we'll see what comes out of this Build Back Better World initiative, which will promptly be renamed or shut down by the next administration. But in the meantime, you know, I think being generous, not being punitive, but rather leading with provision of resources to promote development in a green way is the best thing we can do with respect to the global South, and could have other benefits as well. We've seen how much actually the United States has struggled to gain support in the global South over the war in Ukraine. I think that's quite telling and should really be a wake-up call for U.S. Policymakers. And so, you know, a lot of it, I think, has to do with our own example and our own tangible actions in making green investments at home. And that is something, you know, I think the administration deserves credit for. It's not going to be a smooth process, and we have to work out, you know, how this works internationally, too, so that we don't have big inefficiencies and subsidy races. But you know, I think that's kind of what's necessary to figure out how we actually move to solve this problem.
Stephen Wertheim, Matt Duss, thanks for coming on.
Great to be here. Thanks, John.
My pleasure.